Well, hello, good morning, and welcome to a brand new week. We're on the 28th of October. I'm Alec Hogg, and it's my great pleasure to be your host this morning for the Biz News Briefing. Coming up, South Africa's favorite stockbroker, David Shapiro. He'll be talking to us about Dis-Chem's interims that were released on Friday. Sun International being blocked from taking over Peermont, one of its competitors. Foschini's ventures into the UK, and also in the UK, First Rand hitting some kind of problems there with a acquisition that it made a while back of a company called Aldermore. And of course, Tesla. We can't go forward without looking a little back at a 22% share price jump in Tesla. It's a big constituent of the Biz News portfolio, and we'll have that for that update tomorrow for premium members. So we'll get David's views on Tesla in a little while. Also today we talk politics, crazy things happening in Mozambique, murders, contested election. Makoni Maja will be giving us her insights on that. Also, what is going on with Cyril's bromance with Vladimir Putin? This fellow has been running Russia for a quarter of a century. Democracy? Not. Then we'll hear about Paul Mashatile's intentions to become the next president of South Africa. And there were some interesting by-elections concluded last week that everyone seems to have forgotten about. Makoni is with the Institute for Race Relations. And later in the program, we'll be talking with Rob Futter. And this is a very useful insight into what's going on at Eskom. They have a multi-year price determination. Over the next 3 years, Eskom's going to bump up its prices. And we'll see exactly what that's going to be and why it's so important for us, consumers, for business, and for municipalities. So a heck of a lot coming up for you in the next hour or so. Well, maybe a little less than an hour today, but we've also got some lovely clips as well, insights into what's going on around the world. Starting off with our partners at Bloomberg, here are the news headlines dominated today by the story in the United States of the presidential election, which will be held next week.
Former President Donald Trump has wrapped up his Madison Square Garden event with promises of more tax breaks.
I'm announcing a new policy today that I will support a tax credit for family caregivers who take care of a parent or a loved one. It's about time that they were recognized, right? They add so much to our country and are never spoken of, ever, 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 but they're going to be spoken of now. Thank you all very much. I'll also make interest on car loans fully tax deductible, but only for cars made in America.
Earlier, we heard from a number of celebrities, including Dr. Phil and former pro wrestler Hulk Hogan. Tesla CEO Elon Musk and Cantor Fitzgerald CEO Howard Lutnick were also there.
How much do you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris-Biden budget?
Well, I think we can do at least $2
trillion. Yeah!
Yes.
$2 trillion.
Tesla CEO Elon Musk and Cantor Fitzgerald CEO Howard Lutnick. Both candidates are vying for a last-minute edge, seeking to turn out core supporters and sway the few undecided voters as polls show them in a dead heat heading into November 5th. And Vice President Kamala Harris was on the trail, kicking off the last full week of campaigning.
We have 9 days. 9 days. Until we decide the future of our nation, I see remarkable acts. I see a nation determined to turn the page on hatred and division, to chart a new way forward.
Both candidates are vying for a last-minute edge, seeking to turn out core supporters and sway the few undecided voters as polls show them in a dead heat heading into November 5th. It is just over a week to go before the November presidential election, so how should investors be positioned? That question for Carol Pepper, the CEO of Pepper International.
We're starting to plan, what should we be doing post-election, post the next rate cut, because that's really where you want to look. Just like Wayne Gretzky said, Don't skate to where the puck is, skate to where it's going to be. So we need to stop being focused on the election and terrified. Whoever wins, it will be a fair and free election. There will not be another January 6th, I don't believe. So that means we really should be focusing on what is January 25 going to look like and what's going to happen after the next rate cut.
Pepper was interviewed on Bloomberg Intelligence. It is a busy week ahead for economic data, with Wall Street focused on Friday's jobs report and what the unemployment rate will mean for Federal Reserve policymakers. Steve Ricciotto is chief economist at Mizuho Securities.
You know, I think if it were to drop to 4% on the unemployment rate, I think they're going to have difficulty saying, well, we have to cut rates in November. So I think that's kind of the driver here in terms of where they go in the November meeting. Look, every meeting is live. They want to cut rates. They've told us they want to cut rates. It's just a question of, does the data give them the opportunity?
Well, interesting stuff there, David Shapiro. You got to laugh at Donald Trump. And he's rolling out celebrities now. Elon Musk, oh, he'll take $2 trillion out of the American budget. Like, okay, problem solved. Wow. What do you make of all of that?
Elon Musk is your advisor?
Sure. It's going to be...
You've got Beyonce and Taylor Swift versus Hulk Hogan and Elon Musk. You know, that's the lineup.
Yeah.
So, Alec, you know what the worry is? It's whether or not there's a clean sweep by the Republicans. That's where you need that circuit breaker. So, one of the houses has got to go to the Democrats, either the House or the Senate.
Explain that. Dave, what do you mean by a clean sweep?
It means that the Republicans control the presidency, the Senate, and the House, the Congress. You know, in other words, a whole system. He can push through whatever he wants to. You know, you can get fringe people like Musk having an influence. So at the moment, the call is, I think Trump is just slightly ahead, as much as we don't want that to happen. But I think there might be a chance that the Democrats take the House again, which is the lower house, you know, which is very important in terms of determining policy. So that's the concern. You know, it's not only the presidency, it's the three different elections. You know, and always every 2 years, half the Senate is elected and half the members of the House are elected. So
for us,
that's the concern.
Us here in South Africa as outsiders, we should be hoping that one side or the other don't get the presidency plus the two houses of government, as it were, so that at least there's some kind of a balance on the worst impulses of a gent like Donald Trump.
I was listening to Wesley Clark, funny enough, on Bloomberg this morning being interviewed. And he's a former general, very, very high up. I think he was the NATO general there. And he says that, you know, Trump is a security risk. He says he's a national security risk. He says he takes advice from the last person who gave it to him. So I think most people are very concerned about what a Trump presidency can mean. You know, you mentioned the relationship, I mean, even with Putin, where you mentioned Putin, I mean, the relationship with Putin. And Putin will love it, according to Clark, he says, because if there's conflict between China and America, you know, it suits Putin. He's in the middle, benefiting from both, you know, from both sides.
An interesting development there, David, is that China has been reaching out to America's allies, almost signaling that if Trump wins, they would have to look for other markets. And so they've been talking a lot to the EU, to the British, to Japan even, where there has been quite a lot of history between them. And it's all geopolitics. Why you and I, who talk markets, have been talking markets for decades, why are we actually paying so much attention to this?
It'll be over in 2 weeks. It won't, you know what I mean? It's just that it's headlines at the moment. But I think what we found in the past is a week passes, we get used to the result, and we move on. And I don't think that the people at the lab at Microsoft or the people at the lab at NVIDIA give a damn or give a hoot. They just carry on doing what they do. and America just kind of rolls on. I think the worry is whether he can push through Trump, should he be in, these ridiculous tariffs. I mean, I don't think he's thought them through and what that will mean. You know, tax cuts, additional tariffs. That's why you're finding volatility in the market at the moment. And that's why you're finding volatility in the bond market, because his policies are highly inflationary. You know, tariffs affect everybody. Yes, we're going to increase tariffs so people build factories, you know, in America. How long does it take to build a factory? And how long does it plan a factory? You know, you can't just overnight say, oh, let's build a factory so that we avoid tariffs. You know, it's crazy. And America hasn't got the capacity to fulfill what they do import, although they're not a massive importing nation. So I think everything's distorted. And if he does reduce taxes to the levels that he does, of course that's inflation. You know, it's it certainly increases American debt because you're not receiving the tax revenues.
So our theme song here is Get Context No More. And it was a very interesting part of that clip where Donald Trump said, we will give you kickbacks effectively on American-made motor vehicles. And on the other hand, he wants to keep out Chinese-made electric vehicles. So is there any mystery why Elon Musk is so supportive of the Trump ticket?
He's going to benefit, I think, from SpaceX and from other. You know, he's not only Tesla. He's got a lot of other businesses that are government related. I think SpaceX probably being the biggest. He's also got huge AI capability, and he's got his batteries, his energy storage. So a lot of things that he can get benefits for and tax breaks. He's also big in China. He's got big factories in China. So I don't know where he places himself. He's, you can't read him, you know, and I worry about those kind of characters who you can't read from day to day.
Well, you certainly won't. You
know, including Trump.
Yeah, you won't be able to read Donald Trump. We had the insight from our American on the program, Peter Major, who said, no, please, can't have Trump there because he's just so what he thinks today could change tomorrow. And the point you made earlier, that the last person that he spoke to is the one who seems to have the sway. But David, just to come back before we leave America, Tesla's results were out. Share price was up by 22%. It's not like this is a small company. It's already worth hundreds of billions of dollars. That, I suppose, also tells you that this in Elon We Trust fan club is very, very powerful.
It is. But the other point is that when we spoke last week, you said you'd been speaking to Cy Jacobs, who said he was going to go short or had gone short. I said, that's one thing. And I think a lot of people were squeezed. I think a massive, massive short squeeze. Because when you went through the numbers, in the face of it, they weren't fabulous. I know they weren't great. There were improved margins. There wasn't an increase in revenue. So I'm a bit surprised at the turnaround. You know, I would have expected some kind of jump, maybe 4% or 5% on that, but not the 22% that we're seeing. So it does show you that the market, and I think this is of a broader nature, I think the market was short on tech and short certainly on Tesla. So I think
there's
a scurrying to
come. Just explain that.
You know, in other words, they've when you go short, you sell something that you haven't got, you know, and you borrow the shares from somebody and you sell into the market, you get the cash. And when the share goes up, you know, you've got to now go and buy those shares back. So I think there were a lot of people short. That's the nature of the U.S. of global markets. I don't want to say U.S. markets. You know, there's positions on both sides. It's no longer long only. I mean, just buy shares to hold. People take positions on both sides. Those that they feel prices are going to come down, they sell. You know, and you can borrow stock. So it doesn't. You know, you borrow shares. It's a big business that, and you deliver them into the market, but somewhere along the line, like all borrowings, you've got to pay back. So I think that's happening.
Well, I got hold of Cy, and he said he just doesn't know anymore. So he shook his head. He said, this is just crazy stuff to see Tesla going up like that when all the fundamentals suggest it should not be there, that it should be a lot less lower than it is, the share price is. And I guess, wasn't there that wonderful quote from John Maynard Keynes, one of the great economists, that the market can remain irrational for longer than I can remain solvent? And I guess in this case, did you watch the movie The Big Short? The Steve Eisman, who was one of the leading players there. I remember in 2018, because we had Tesla in the Biz News portfolio, and he famously went hugely short at that stage. And so we thought, well, okay, he's got to know something, in addition to all the craziness that was going on. So we sold the stock out of the Biz News portfolio, and I'm kicking myself ever since, because you shouldn't be doing that. And Steve Eisman was carried out on a stretcher on that one as well. So it seems anyone who takes Elon Musk on, especially now, has got to be careful.
There's a famous quote by Howard Marks, and it's a lovely remark. He says there's so many people in financial markets who've made their reputation for getting things right once in a row. So be careful. The fact that they might have called the 1987 crash, or they might have called, doesn't give them immunity from making mistakes into the future.
David, just coming back home, when I lived in Mondi, or it feels like 100 years ago, there was a little chemist there called Dischem, one little chemist that started in Mondial. And from there, it's become a giant in South Africa. There's Dischems pretty much in any major shopping center in the country and elsewhere as well. Their results were out on Friday. After all the focus on the news, if you want to release your results, don't do it on a Friday. Or if you want to keep them quiet, don't do it on a Friday. Was there anything in that you saw from their interims?
No, it's a good, solid operation. The market moved in down. They might have missed guidance, or they might have missed analyst forecasts, but there's nothing there. Alec, what's important is you knew that chemist was run by the Saltzman, Mr. and Mrs. Saltzman, and it's progressed from there. And I think that they pulled out at the right time. When I say they pulled out, they've handed over the reins. I can't pronounce his name, Roy, R-U-E-M-O-R-A-I-S. I'm always going to get it wrong, especially if there's a French or European kind of pronunciation, Roy. But he's doing very good things. And they're transforming this from that small chemist into a major national brand. And give them time. Clix has got a long start on them, but Clix is a much smaller format. Clix focuses on beauty. This is much more on other areas, on prescriptions, and also on those powders that make you tough, so whenever you go. But a good operation. I don't think we can fault anything in those results, even though they might have just fallen short of where analysts thought they'd be. But double-digit growth in earnings, good enough for me, yeah.
Sun International had a run at Pyrmont, and it now appears as though the Competition Commission does not like this. You would have thought, just as an outside observer, that it's unlikely that the competition authorities in South Africa would have allowed a deal in the first place. So what is your reading of this?
I agree with you. I agree. You've only got three major operators, Sun International, Pyrmont, and Sorghum. So you're taking out Pyrmont. And I think the Emperor is their jewel, which is in Kempton Park. These are the casinos. So I thought it was very unlikely that this would go through, just to have two casino operators. I'm not sure what they can do with the power, but especially with things now moving towards sports betting, which you do on your phone at home, But this is a big casino, in a very built-up area, Emperor. So I'm sure it's around that. And Sun International hasn't got anything. They've got Sun City, but nothing in a big metropolis. Whereas I think Togo's got Monte Cassino. Am I getting it wrong?
No, that's right.
Togo's got Monte Cassino. So I think that's why they wanted something like that, because the smaller rural casinos are not doing well. They're not doing what they used to do. So I think you need the big Emperor, Monte Cassino, maybe Sun International, Grand West in the Cape, and so on. That's where the money's being made. So it's not surprising that this was turned down.
You often hear when these big deals are done that they get whispered from the competition authorities, look, get rid of that, get rid of this, and then you've got a chance. In other words, don't give us too much power concentration and we then can let this go through. Yeah. Has Sun International done anything in preparation, or might they now go back to the drawing boards and say, okay, well, perhaps we should be doing X, Y, Z to make this deal happen?
What are they going to sell? You know, no one's interested in those smaller operations. So I don't know. You've got to hear from Sun International what their plan is. But this is a big one. You know, this is Piedmont, the emperor. So and it's not quoted, so we really don't know the numbers that well. You know, this is I can't remember whether it was quoted at one stage.
It was, indeed, it was. Yeah. Ernie Jabert, it was quite a big business. I think RMB were involved there as well. So a lot of disappointment for people who were trying to push that deal through. Not so much disappointment for Fashini. I see that the story that came out on the Stock Exchange News Service on Friday about this company called White Stuff. So South Africans have had I suppose you could call it a very spotty track record, especially in the retail industry in the UK. We know Christo Wiese's a disaster there with Brait. Is this something that you'd be looking into and saying bull point for Fashini?
I like Fashini. I like where the management's taking this business. I think they're very, very progressive. I think in everything that they do, although even if you go to Total Sports, you still have to sign your name on a piece of paper. I can't understand why they haven't upgraded their systems. But a nice operation, and you know, in all the areas that they're going into, this is kind of a bolt-on, although they do say that it's going to up their offshore exposure quite dramatically. I don't know White Stuff. I mean, I don't know if you know it at all. You know, there's so many chains, Alec. There's so many chains. I know they've got Hobbs and something else, Whispers and that, but I've got no feel for any of those. Things have settled down, as we've seen with Truworths and Office. You know, they're starting to settle down now. But I don't know if it's massive in their lives. And I don't know what special magic they're going to bring it. But I'm with you as well. These are areas that have never favoured South Africans whenever they've gone offshore, particularly in the retail side, you know, as we see with Woolworths, with Country Road and David Jones and that. So it always makes me sit up. But I think they do need a little bit of diversification. So, but I like the group, you know, and I think we'll watch, you know, the jury's out on these things, because when they get ugly, they can get very ugly.
And First Rand's problems with Aldermore and what it's inherited there. It's also in the UK. Maybe give us a bit of background on that one and what's going on here.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a legal person, and when I have to read legal judgments and that, they don't make sense. Alec, this is around commissions paid on the raising of finance for motor vehicle finance. And what I read in the judgment is, number one, they didn't disclose certain hidden commissions, you know, to agents, which I would assume Aldermore is one. And I think the other worry is whether it's legal or not to pay those. That's the one I can't figure out what the judge said. But judging, and that's what I'm saying, judging from the reaction in the US, in the UK, banks came crashing down. There were some big, big downward movements in some of the banks because of this. So I think it's something we've got to go into in greater detail. You know, you've got to unpack what the judgment means and what the whole system is. First Rand got off lightly, was down slightly 2%, but I think that's in line with what we did see in the market. But obviously, Aldermore is placed in that area and receives kind of commissions on the on these contracts. But don't take me as a legal expert. You know, I'm the worst person. Whenever I see legalese, I just move on.
Banking is.
But it's obviously had some impact and is worrying the bankers in the UK.
David Shapiro is with Sasfin Wealth. I suppose we better make that distinction now, because David's with the good guys on Sasfin, not those who got themselves into problems. And we will talk to him as per usual every Monday. And thanks, Dave, as you have brought us up to date on so many important issues in the investment world. We're going to be talking with Rob Futter in just a moment. Rob is an expert on what's going on in the ESKIM field of influence. But before we get there, every Sunday evening, my colleague Chris Stain gets together with Neil DeBeer and they have a conversation on the political front. Now, we're going to have our own political conversation in just a little while with Makoni Maja, but here's a clip from last night's discussion. And Neil, as per always, is not holding back.
And there comes this debate. Is the ANC, is Cyril Ramaphosa willing to get up and grow some rugby balls and say to those who are indicted, who are mentioned, who are ANC accused, number one, to get up and say, Clark, yay, yay, and yay, you are going to go to court, and if found guilty, you are going into orange. That is the critical thing we need from this president, Chris. We need this man to get up and to say, I am not going to allow another decade of this ANC with the scoundrels, the hyenas and the looters, no, not outside, who sit amongst us. That is what Citizen X, Chris, that's what you and I currently want to see. We don't want to see propaganda. We want to see action. We want to see that even at the NEC meeting, when they finished with their lamb, when they finished with their potato, as an age stuff, there should be a couple of trucks waiting and go, Okapolka stalkers, yay op die klavier. You, don't go to your black BM, go into the red car. That's what I think we should have, as public as that. Because I fear if that's not done, Chris, if that is not done, that you will have a palace revolution in this country where people are going to say, if you don't clean up the shit, we are going to clean up the ship and we're going to clean the ship from the start to the end. And I don't think that's where this country should go. This ship of South Africa should have been cleansed a long time ago. And now I'm going to end with one shocking revelation. What if the GNU were the sterling work of certain ministers, majority of them not in the ANC? What if the people that back the ANC past and present stand back and see that the government of this country has become so efficient that home affairs and police and everything is working and there are buildings because of Dean McPherson and construction sites and they're getting work? Because what happens in 2029 when the people of this country, the mass illiterate, the mass propaganda actually turns around and goes, wow, this government actually has done better? And they tell everybody it was the ANC that did it, and they go back to majority. Chris, can you imagine if that happens in 2029, that the ANC turns around, takes all of this accolade, tells the people who are their cult followers that you got more jobs, you got more construction, you got more safety and security, you got better borders, because of the ANC government? I'm telling you, Chris, this is a new edge sword to think about, and don't underestimate the sneakiness of the ANC, one of the oldest liberation movements in the world.
Well, we are going to be talking a lot of politics a little bit later in the program with Makoni, but right now we are going to be looking more at the story with ESKIM. Now, Rob Futter is a director at Cresco, and that's a specialist project finance company. And Cresco is their business is to check what's going on the project side. We'll be bringing him up in, just in a moment. I know you're in the UK, Rob. Nice to see you, man. Are you doing business over there, or are you primarily based there or in South Africa?
Morning, Alec. Hi. I'm actually here for an energy conference that focuses on different technologies being deployed in Africa. So here for 3 days.
And
it's
has
a little bit early. The clocks went back last night, so it's still cold and very, very dark. But good to see you.
Well, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. And in fact, you were prepared to even talk to us on Friday just after you'd landed. I thought maybe we'd both be in a better place if we spoke today. But last week was very important for people like you, and I guess anybody who's watching Eskom and energy prices, because the multi-year price determination from Eskom was released. Just explain why, what it is and why it's so important, if you would.
So Eskom makes a three-year application every rolling 3 years to NERSA. NERSA then goes out on a public commentary in which everyone from large users to individuals makes comments on this. And the application is based on Eskom price increases, and those price increases are typically referenced to a cost of service study, so what Eskom costs to produce energy, a return on investment, and then a few ups and overs based on subsidies and bits and pieces that we won't get into, but the bulk of it is made up of generation and a return on equity. And that methodology supports the increases that are much announced, and obviously everyone's eyes open when they hear 35-40%. NERSA then comes back and approves that, and then that is what Eskom puts through its initially tariffs, and then those tariffs flow down to municipal tariffs and what you and I pay every day.
It sounds a bit weird that you've got this set formula, because I guess we all know, you don't have to be a genius to work out that accounting can be creative, and if you working basing your increases on what your asset base is, given that you can move assets in and out and do all kinds of interesting things, if you need more money to keep more people employed or to keep, I don't know, the company jet going, well, if this is the basis on which you decide to, that the authorities decide on how much price to give you, it just seems a little bit weird, especially as we now are moving into a much more competitive arena for the provision of electricity.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a international standard with a little bit of South Africa specific input, but mostly an international standard that most utilities use that are typically not unbundled and not liberalized. And it's really a return on asset base. NERSA uses a similar methodology in the tank storage industry and in the gas industry. So it's very much a square peg in a round hole, unfortunately. We've made a number of these applications, and it's never perfect, but it is an international standard. It has a number of flaws. NERSA actually came up with its own approach to the methodology too, and that also didn't work. So it's never a perfect science, and yes, you could argue that if you spend more, doesn't mean that you were efficient about that. But there is some level of efficiencies or calculations that are done of the analysis, but it's not perfect. But it's what we've been used to, and at least there is some credibility and consistency in some cases in terms of how that methodology is applied. And we take comfort from that.
But not much for the moment. Not much credibility amongst business who are looking at a 30% increase. What? Just explain what this means for people trying to build a business in South Africa, and indeed for consumers.
Well, I mean, so we're obviously focused very much on the renewable side at the moment for very large clients. So a 30% increase in the energy tariff makes renewables even more and more affordable. So the renewable guys are very excited, but unfortunately at the moment, the bulk of that energy that we're getting from renewables is very small relative to what they're still buying from Eskom, irrespective of where the energy comes from. So the inputs are tiny, really, relative to them. But a 35% increase or a 30% or maybe even, I think we did some analysis that on average, Eskom gets about 56%, and don't hold me to that number, but in that grade of what they ask for on a rolling basis. So you're even a 15, 16% increase, if we assume that NERSA eventually suggest that over 3 years, is going to be a serious issue for a lot of South African businesses, specifically large energy users, where energy is a large component of their cost base, and they're already on the edge. Ferrochrome, platinum has been thing. So now this has a material impact on many businesses.
Would it move them towards self-provision, i.e. doing deals of their own, putting up their own renewable operations? Does it become economically viable?
Well, I mean, there's already a lot of those plans. So, I mean, maybe just to understand the structure. So, I mean, many corporates require renewables outside of a pure financial benefit. There's CBAM coming and carbon tax and all these sort of benefits. So there is an element of renewables already in the Eskom tariff from the government procurement programs there. So there's a portion, but it's really small as a kind of. So a lot of large users and smaller users, just like you and I, putting solar on our rooftop become cheaper. So large corporates are doing the same thing. Obviously, there's not enough rooftop to fire up a ferrochrome smelter, so you need a lot of utility scale PV. And they're doing that already. And Sasol, with their current procurements of 800 megs, gets them to about 18% renewable. It's a start, but it's still far away from, I guess, what will have a meaningful financial impact and a meaningful carbon offset impact. But there are a lot of plans in place, and we're seeing improvement there. And the work we're doing, a lot of it is turning from Excel into real projects, which wasn't the case 3 years ago. So we're seeing some interesting stuff.
So if you're an investor, you're standing on the sidelines looking at SA Inc., which has had a fantastic, the stocks have had a fantastic run after the Government of National Unity was put together. Is this something that should be frightening you now, given that for many of these companies, not everybody's a smelter, but for many of these companies, electricity is a major issue. Would you be worried, given what Eskom has put on the table?
So that's maybe a little bit above my macroeconomic area of focus. I'm more at the project level, as you mentioned, but happy to make a comment. But I mean, yes, obviously, longevity of assets based on a increasing energy price is a real concern. I guess as South Africa is becoming a lot less deindustrialized and now a bit more service-based businesses typically have less energy requirements. Although saying that, data centers are getting very energy hungry. So we might see a decline in ferrochrome smelters, but we're seeing an increase in data center requirements. Definitely not to the same level there, but there is a bit of interest. But the world's energy prices are also increasing. So, we're not sitting alone. And South Africa's cost of energy is actually quite a bit lower than countries north of our border are there. So relative to our peers in our area, we're probably not too bad. I think our bigger issues around investors looking on the outside is the overall story. Transport, logistics, energy, the story itself is difficult to sell, but as an energy as a point, it is a concern but there. But on the other side, if you're a renewable energy investor, there's so many opportunities in South Africa. I mean, the South African grid and the potential for renewables and linkages with that the numbers just get so big. People always ask us, why are you not doing more work on the continent? And we are just north of our borders, Zambia and Zimbabwe and stuff, because it's part of the South African pool. But just by megawatts, we can do more in three deals in South Africa than we can do in the whole of West Africa. So, sheer focus, it's in South Africa at the moment.
Rob, just to close off with, we've seen all three of the major tech companies announcing that they're going into nuclear plants. The one is buying Three Mile Island. The others are putting up their own nuclear plants, which I guess you would be classified as renewables. Nuclear's had a very bad name in South Africa for good reason. The attempted theft by the Zumaites, or the Zuptas as they were termed. Are you, though, seeing some potential there for South African players, particularly in these smaller nuclear, as we used to have with the pebble bed reactors?
Yeah, so I mean, we already have Kuberg, and there was a process that was out there last year or earlier in this year in which large corporates were looking to buy the environmental attributes of Kuberg. Unfortunately, that didn't go anywhere, or fortunately, it didn't go anywhere, because if you can't double count, so you can't buy it and then I can also claim it. So if you bought it, then my carbon footprint goes up because you've taken my credits. So that didn't happen. So that is an opportunity. Designing getting a project up and running for nuclear is like 15 years. So it's not going to happen very, very quickly, never mind there. And then on the small scale one, we're doing a lot of on-site PV and BESS projects for data centers, and we're getting large penetration rates. We can get to 60-70% with that on-site. and on-site also gives you security of supply. So the nuclear needs to kind of be next door to your building, and most of the data centers that we're involved in are sitting in urban areas. And we can imagine getting an environmental approval when you explain to someone that what used to be on a small nuclear submarine is now sitting next to your transformer up the road from you. In theory, I think it's a good idea. In reality, I think there's some real practice. Whereas PV and BESS that people are used to next door to your transformer, that's more acceptable.
Rob Futter is with Cresco, and that gives us some good insights into what's going on the Eskom side. Oof, Eskom is still very, very front and center. Just to remind you that we do have Dan Morricani, the chief executive of Eskom, coming to the BizNews conference in March next year. If you haven't booked yet, tickets are going pretty quickly. And this is from the 11th to the 13th of March in Hermanus. Magnificent place to come in March. And we will have 25 keynote speakers led by Paul Mashatile, who will be part of the conversation in just a moment with Makoni Maja from the Institute for Race Relations. Before we get there, though, let's just bring you up to date with another development in the Southern African region, the election in Mozambique. My colleague Chris Steyn spoke over the weekend to Tertius Jacobs, who's an analyst on Mozambique.
From what we have seen is there have been district courts that have confirmed that there were results of election manipulation. There has been reports from neighboring Zimbabwe and investigative journalists claiming that they were actually able to partake in the vote in Mozambique's vote, not with them being Zimbabwean nationals, and they've interviewed other Zimbabwean nationals that have done the same. Again, the credibility of this, it is 50-50. And then the big issue that really stands out, and this is more subtext, Mondlane has a massive following, a massive support, especially in Maputo City, massive, massive support from the youth. And the issue that we are seeing is that Chapo won across the board. In Maputo City, where it is suspected that Mondlane, that the race would have been at least close, in Maputo City itself, Chapo got 54% of the vote and Mondlane 34%. The race should have been closer. So there are a lot of questions in terms of all of that. There have been more serious allegations of election manipulation from the European Union election observer. They released a press statement saying that they were not allowed to observe the counting of the votes, and they are concerned that the National Elections Commission does not want to make public the district result sheet, essentially those information per polling station of the votes. The CNE refuses to make this public. So even the European Union is saying that, you know, the whole thing is, and there's been a lot of irregularities and it has been questionable at best. So disregarding all of the local discontent, all of the opposition are claiming manipulation and irregularities, and local analysts and observers, all of that aside, a big entity like the European Election Observer Mission is saying, you know, this was not a transparent and entirely credible process.
Makoni Maja joins us now. Sure, what's going on in our region, Makoni? We've got all the issues in Zimbabwe. Now it looks like Mozambique is equally dodgy as far as global observers are concerned. We've got a lot to talk about with South Africa, with the BRICS, with Mashatile and so on, but a take on what's going on in Mozambique?
Hi, Alec. Good morning, and thank you for having me. Yeah, it's very concerning to see a little bit of disruption in the SADC region. You'll know that South Africa plays a big role in that area. And our relations with Mozambique are quite strong. They provide South Africa with gas and electricity. And I believe they are also, South Africa is the second biggest population of immigrants from the region as well. So it is deeply concerning, and also to observe that with all the allegations and the reports of election interference, be it in the form of detentions or arbitrary arrests of journalists, civil society organizations, or even outright assault and violence being perpetuated against civilians who are protesting. That, in light of that, the president issued a statement congratulating the Mozambique government on preliminary release of election results. I think we could definitely make a stronger stance that reflects our democratic values, given that elections are key to functioning democracies. So yeah, I was hoping to hear a more stronger stance from the president, I'll say.
He's making some rather strange statements, and just going up to the one that's causing unhappiness within the government of national unity, calling Vladimir Putin our ally. And I can see why some people are unhappy about that, including John Steenhuisen, who let everybody know that this was the ANC's view, not the South African view. But what do young people think about this? And I gave it some thought. Those ANC members who were supported or who trained in the Soviet Union have now got to be in their 60s at the least. And surely young people who do believe in democracy will say, but hang on, Putin's been running that place for the last 25 years. And he's even changed the constitution to make sure that he keeps running it. Isn't amongst young people, do they see it the same way as Cyril Ramaphosa and maybe people of his age do, that Putin's our friend, he's our ally, he helped us 40 years ago, we should be still on his side, despite whatever he might be doing that other people or the international community doesn't like?
I would divide the youth's opinion on this into two. One, I think there are very much a part of our youth who still feel aggrieved by apartheid and by the West's neglect of, you know, the struggle of Black people during that time. And so do agree that Russia is an ally, given that it trained certain MK forces within the ANC. But I would also look very much at the foot traffic of youth immigrants, right, where South African youth emigrate to. And I don't see them going to countries like Russia or China. I mean, sure, there are some here or there taking up teaching opportunities in China. But most people that I see leaving the country as far as the youth is concerned, and this is across the races, is to countries like the UK and the US. And Australia. So I think you could pretty much cut the youth up in two, and as far as where our position lie on aligning ourselves with the East versus the West.
It's a pity as well that the revisionist history has completely forgotten the role of the West in bringing down apartheid. If we hadn't had the debt standstill in 1985 after the Rubicon speech, who knows where we might be today. But the West pulled all the credit facilities from South Africa. Interest rates went to 25%. It's almost like, don't really understand finance, but hey, I want to go and see the guys who were shooting. And they didn't shoot too well. And we know that from history. But revision is the way it is. And what about this support of Putin? And could it hurt South Africa, given we should be non-aligned, according to Jaki Cilia? He said, we've been played by the Russians and the Chinese for a long time. If we remain non-aligned, it's a very powerful position to be in for the country.
Absolutely, especially in the next coming years, where the high-growth economies of China and Western economies in the EU as well as the US are forecasted to experience some strain in growth. That means that emerging markets such as South Africa will be primed for investors who are looking to invest. And so it's very important that in our foreign policy, we align ourselves or position ourselves to take advantage of those strain that will be on the Western countries. I do think that as far as the GNU is concerned, that we should expect this, that the ANC is struggling to deal with its break in hegemony. And so they've recently established a dispute resolution mechanism. And I'm sure that that'll create opportunity for them to reposition South Africa on the globe and geopolitically, where our stance is not reflected by the ANC as it always has been. And I also think it's kind of understandable that they're struggling with this. This is very much new for them, 30 years into democracy. I do think that they are not used to consulting on every single statement they have to issue about the country. But I do think the clearinghouse presents an opportunity for them to handle those ructions. I think there's an element of this that's also a bit performative. I'm sure you would have seen the exchange between Leon Schreiber and Vincent Magwenya, the spokesperson to the president, where Leon Schreiber tweeted using the words friend and ally repeatedly about a new visa regime between us and Ukraine, where we will be giving visa-free entrance to Ukrainian bureaucrats. And as Leon Schreiber celebrated that milestone in his capacity as Minister of Foreign Affairs, Vincent Magwenya quickly entered on scene to clarify that, no, this was actually in the works, has been in the works since 2020, in case Schreiber thought of taking this or claiming this as a DA victory. So we're dealing with these GNU partners jostling for power, putting on a performance that says, you know, the code goes, politics is showbiz for ugly people. But I think there is an element of this that's very much putting on a show, especially to the public, virtue signaling to the public about where the different GNU parties stand, as opposed to where the GNU as a collective stand. So I take Mr. Steenhuisen's point that Russia is the ANC's ally, not necessarily an ally of South Africa, especially GNU South Africa.
Neil de Beer made an interesting point when he was talking to Chris on Sunday about the successes of the GNU coming into 2029 likely to be spun as an ANC success rather than anything that the DA could leverage to its account. Is he right to be concerned about that, or indeed anybody who supports the DA concerned that they might be being played by the ANC in the same way as the ANC has been played by Russia, China, according to Jacques Celia?
So far, there's no outright winner, it seems, between the GNU parties. We recently did a poll as the Institute of Race Relations. And one of the questions we asked is how favorably people view the different parties within the GNU. And the ANC was at a 41%. The DA was around about 22%. What I will say is that Mr. Ramaphosa's favorability has improved. He is back now to taking up majority favorability among all politicians in South Africa. I think his is 50 or just slightly over 50 percentage points. So far, I don't think we're seeing how the GNU reflects on those parties. And I think it's been fairly too early. It's just over 100 days. They just celebrated that milestone recently. So I think we should give it a bit more time before we can proclaim who gets to walk away with the GNU victory.
Okay, Paul Mashatile. He has over the weekend in the Sunday Times saying he's ready if they want to make him president. He's quite keen to do that. And yet there's a lot of controversy around him from many different quarters. What's your reading of this?
Yeah, this question has been coming up quite a lot in the media where high-ranking ANC officials are being asked about whether they would throw their hats in the ring. I will say the NEC, the next electoral conference for the ANC, is still some years away. And as I indicated, the president, Ramaphosa, is still the most liked and favored president. So I'm sure they'll be keeping him, dare I say, full term. Kgosietso Ramakgoba was also recently asked on a different podcast whether he would throw his hand up to be president of the organization, and he said he would not shy away from raising his hand. And so I think we're seeing a lot of that ANC officials positioning themselves or conditioning us to begin viewing them as potential successors to Mr. Ramaphosa. There were also allegations when there was some tension between Mr. Lesufi and Mr. Secretary General of the ANC Mbalula, when Mbalula was trying to rein in Mr. Lesufi and and discipline him for not walking in lockstep with some of the NEC's positions on different things, specifically coalitions with the DA. That was also seen as the two of those leaders, you know, showing their different power within the organization, but also very much conditioning us to start seeing them as potential leaders of the ANC. So I think Mashatile joins that list of candidates in the ANC who are obviously cognizant of the fact that this is Mr. Ramaphosa's last term, and that, yeah, they want their members and the rest of the branches, as Mr. Mashatile say, to start ruminating on that question of who's to come next.
You didn't mention Ronald Lamola.
Yeah, Ronald doesn't have the sort of position in government that I think gives him the opportunity to present his leadership as much. He's been quite silent, actually, since the formation of the GNU. But he's definitely a contender. I think he was liked by branches in Limpopo. So I do think a lot of the competition will be coming from Gauteng, because that's where those leaders that I mentioned, be it Mr. Ramaphosa or Mashatile or even Mr. Lesufi, emerge. But I do think in the northern province of Limpopo, Lamola is definitely a force to be reckoned with.
And to close off with, there were by-elections last week. The DA retained 5 seats, and the PA, Gaydon McKenzie's party, won a seat from the Good Party. Now, the PA hasn't won many seats since the November 2021 election, so to win a ward is quite a big deal there, yet not much comment. What's your thinking? Is the PA generally making strides?
There has been criticism of Gaydon McKenzie that whilst he's embracing his new role within the GNU, he has neglected his duties in his party with respect to growing that party. And so I think this kind of pours some cold water on that, because it's good progress for the Patriotic Alliance. Another one to take note of, which is an observation by Marius Ruetz, one of my colleagues, is that the EFF was a no-show in all of these by-elections, from the ones in the Western Cape to the ones in Mpumalanga, to the one that took place in Tshwane. And so that's very much unlike the EFF, because not even having the faintest of chances in winning a by-election has never stopped them before from running, and yet they were a no-show. So that's definitely indicative of some of the issues or battles within EFF leadership at present. Another one that I would point our audience to is that Cape Exit got 13.41% in one of those by-elections in Cape Town. So there seems to be momentum for the Cape Independence Group within the Western Cape, although not much. But surprisingly, a 13% to me sounds like quite much. But yeah, the DA retained those 5 seats, so it still dominates the Western Cape. And including its increase in vote share in eMalahleni, where it grew by 20 percentage points. I believe in the last by-election, they got in the late 60%, and now they got 80%. So they are growing in that region.
Makoni Maja is campaign manager at the Institute for Race Relations. Thanks for bringing us up to date, Makoni. And I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews, from our technical producer, who is Ruan Erasmus, our executive producer, Lucy Ferreira, and of course, yours truly. We look forward to being back in your company again tomorrow. We'll have the latest business news and all of the issues that really make a difference for us here in South Africa, not just as investors, but as citizens. Until then, 7 a.m. tomorrow. Cheerio.